Today's program has been brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit internationalculinarycenter.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, Executive Vice President of the James Beard Foundation. And every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, we have a conversation about taste. Sometimes that's a noisy conversation. But today we have a special edition of the show because the James Beard Foundation in October was hosting one of our annual food conferences. And the theme of this conference was the paradox of appetite. And we brought in from all over the world some of the great thinkers about food and culture and appetite and all of the things that go around that. And today I'm really excited to have with me on the show Claude Fischler, who is one of the senior investigators at the National Center of Research in France, but perhaps more broadly known as a great thinker about food and across cultures, not just in France, but comparatively the concept of the omnivore, the challenges of the omnivore, let's say, was an idea that he put in people's minds. And we're just very excited to be able to have a conversation with him for the next 30 minutes about topics that we are all passionate about. So thank you for joining us. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. So I just want to start by asking you a question that's probably a bit unfair. We are in a moment right now where in America, certainly, and even as I travel around the world and as you travel around the world, you see people are just crazy about food. I mean, it's being fetishized beyond reason. And I wonder if you could reflect on that a little bit for us, just to start, and how we might find ourselves in this place.
Well, that's interesting. Well, it's been fetishized on the one hand, and on the other hand, it's been trivialized. So basically, what we're witnessing is, on the one hand, food has never been, at least in the developed world or even in the emerging world, it's never been so easy to procure. It's everywhere. It requires less and less effort, no preparation, no ceremonial. So it's become really trivialized. And on the other hand, maybe as a reaction to a certain point in certain areas of societies, there is a tremendous enthusiasm growing about food and gastronomy, etc. And mind you, even France has been taken over by those food shows or cooking shows like Top Chef and Master Chef and that sort of thing, complete with the English titles.
Really?
Yes, which I find particularly shocking, after all, because nobody knows what Master Chef means or Top Chef. It could be chef. Period.
Right. Right.
And I think it was Michael Pollan in one of his articles in the New York Times that wrote once that as people cook less and less, they watch the shows more and more, which is, makes cooking, turns it into a spectator sport.
Right.
All right. But a number of people are practicing, and as often, I think, is the case, when you have a major basic trend, you can witness the emerging of some counter trends, minority trends, things like, locavores. Who, 20 years ago, who would have thought that in America, farmer markets would sprout all over the place and people would talk about eating local stuff and regional stuff. I can still remember my good friend in New York, maybe 30 years ago, 35 years ago, telling me there's no such thing as American cuisine. It's never existed. And, we don't have a cuisine. So
No one cares.
And we're going to get whatever we get in terms of cuisine. We'll have to get it from abroad. Mm-hmm. And then came something called American Nouvelle, and then came Fusion, and then came, well, together with Fusion, some confusion, etc. and so on. And we're there.
Indeed. And we're there in a place, as you say, where there are perhaps a lot of different moments happening at the same time. So a group of people fascinated and obsessed almost about locavorism, shopping at the farmer's market. Others, as you mentioned, who just want everything done and want to pick it up and eat it in their car in the cup holders, like they put the cookies now and stuff, so you don't even have to chew, or practically. And a lot of what you've researched and written about is this loss of ritual, as you mentioned, around food. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the role that you see the ritual of the meal playing comparatively in America and France and some of the other places you've looked at, and why you think that's important to perhaps find or replace in some way.
Well, Mitchell, this is a great question, but yes. It'll take a couple of your programs. But all right. If you look at, you know, humans, they generally do not like to eat alone. It's something you can check in the anthropological literature, or just traveling around, or even in surveys. We did a survey, a comparative survey of three countries in 2005 with a group at Princeton, and it was not about food. It was happiness and well-being. We asked people to tell us everything they had been doing the day before from morning to evening. And of course, I looked at the eating episodes. And for each episode of their choice, the subject's choice, we asked a few questions about where, when, what, how, and rate. We asked them to rate the episode in terms of emotions experienced. And it turns out that every single food episode, eating episode, is rated higher. No, not every single one, but I mean statistically, right. The eating episodes are always rated higher when they are taken with someone, in all three countries. So it means that even Americans, who spend probably more often alone than a large part of the world population, even in this country. Mm-hmm. People prefer to have company when eating. It sounds like it's obvious, but we should remember this once in a while. And why is that? I mean, obviously, eating, we have forgotten this in this country in particular, but mostly everywhere. Mm-hmm. Eating is not a personal, individual activity. It's not just another form of consumption, like buying clothes or a car or some, washing powder or whatever. It's something that is done socially, and that's what I call commensality. We call it commensality. Mensa is the table, so sharing the table or a meal without a table even is commensality, displaying commensalism. And, if we look at this in terms of evolution, it makes perfect sense, and it's perfectly understandable, and it's just striking that it has been overlooked so much, particularly recently with the current interest in food. It begins with hunting, of course. There's cooperation for hunting. Mm-hmm. There's a good part of human evolution takes place under the mode of production of hunting and gathering. Once you've hunted particularly big game, you have to share it. Mm-hmm. It's not just the good hunter that eats meat. And hunter-gatherers typically live in groups of about 25, 30 people. So how does the protein how is it shared? Well, they have very elaborate rules, the hunter-gatherers, to share the food and dispatch it according to who saw the game and who cooperated and so on. So basically, if you look at not just hunter-gatherers, but even contemporary societies, or if you go to Africa, where the meal is so important and it's so social and ritualized, you see that people eating alone are just suspected of a number of things. They're suspected of maybe casting a spell over the meal, or maybe even poisoning something in the meal, or at least to have some kind of bad intentions, or snatching away something from the from other people's food. And all this stuff is still present maybe in our minds somewhere or in our societies or culture somehow. It's just that we don't always remember it. But, you know, I was looking the other day at some people in Paris having an apéritif cocktails before dinner, and there were peanuts on the table. It's customary to serve peanuts or chips. And when there is one peanut left, hardly anyone takes it.
Right.
I don't know, we are embarrassed or something. And it reminds me of an anecdote by an American anthropologist, Lorna Marshall, who was once giving her people, Bushmen in South Africa, or she was having them taste some dried meat, I think, or corned beef or something like that. And she noted that they were taking very little. Each of them was taking very little of the stuff, so that at the end, the last one had more than anyone else. So this kind of polite behavior with people who are always under the stress of starvation or uncertainty was really striking. And I think this is something we should remember. And it's not just that, I'm not just talking about the, courtly meal feast at the court in Versailles or in Florence in the 16th century or something like that. It's not just the etiquette and the pomp of the event. It's just also the common meal. The common meal is actually something that reflects a number of things we've forgotten. We don't realize anymore. I see on Amazon, when I'm looking for books about this, a bunch of books about saying grace. Religion,
right.
Where has saying grace disappeared? And what does it mean? So it's not just that there is a religious dimension to the meal, but there's also an educational dimension to the meal. There is the fact that the meal, the family meal, the common meal is the occasion on which children are taught unknowingly, even the parents don't necessarily realize this,
right.
Some very basic rules about living in society, in a particular culture, about hierarchy, about seniority, about priorities of all kinds, of solidarity, and the way to behave. Now we call it etiquette. And we think it's just a mark of prestige or something like that. But I mean, it's essential. So that's the extent of the importance of the matter of eating together. It's not just that's important too. When you eat the same food, the implicit notion is that you're making the same flesh.
Mm.
You're becoming more like each other sharing the food. So of course, it accounts for a number of occasions in which we eat with people we don't necessarily appreciate.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. We are talking with, or actually listening to, Claude Fischler, no apologies. It's fascinating. I could listen for hours, and maybe we will. This is Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I'm your host. We'll be right back.
You are listening to Got the Feeling by the California Honey Drops on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
The International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis. I'll remind people listening, especially if you're listening to the podcast or to the archive, that you can email us questions or comments you have about any of the shows, this one in particular, at info@heritageradionetwork.org, or you can tweet us at Taste Matters HRN if you prefer 140-character comments, which people seem to do these days, not unlike the short abbreviated meals that we are enjoying.
But maybe I should practice this.
Maybe you should. So you made me think about so many things, Claude, about habits that have formed here in America or that you see happen. And one of them, well, there's two things I want to ask you about. One is, is a social group eating a meal at a McDonald's different from a social meal somewhere else? Is that shared commensality dependent in any way on the caliber and the quality of the food, do you think? We like to think it is in the good food movement or among ourselves that perhaps there's something more given in the scenario when we're eating better food. But I wonder.
I think it's not so much in the food as in the people, because in the culture, it's an interesting topic. McDonald's in France does 80% of its business at mealtimes. Mm. The way the French use McDonald's is entirely different.
Right, interesting.
Nobody is going to show up at 10 in the morning and just grab a hamburger and eat it in the car.
I was in the airport in Chicago at O'Hare, and the McDonald's was the busiest place this morning at 10 a.m. Yeah.
They do very good business in France, much to the surprise of our American friends.
Right.
And actually, it turns out it was initially to the surprise of the people in Chicago, too, when the European management took over, or French management took over the operation. What they did was just observe and take into account the local customs. And people don't show up until it's 12:30.
Right, time for
And lunch. Then they order more items than in America. They are more often together with other people. Mm. They eat on the spot instead of taking out more often than here. In short, they use it more like an ordinary restaurant. And even when they use the drive-in service, they don't eat in the car as much as they do here.
Home.
They just drive 200 yards and then pull out and improvise a picnic.
Okay.
This is official official information gathered by interviews with the people at McDonald's.
I'm not sure I want to think about that picnic in France around a Big Mac and French fries, but okay, we'll go there. And the other question that this notion of commensality brought up for me is that today in America, one of the things you find is even among people eating together is they're all actually eating separately because this one can't eat this and that one doesn't like that and this one's a vegetarian. And so you're having 9 people at a table, each having their own meal. And you mentioned the idea of sharing the protein, the hunter-gatherer sort of the hierarchy of distribution, and I wonder what you think of that scenario, which is
so
ever
funny
more common.
You should bring this up, because actually last year we had an international meeting in Paris at the Pasteur Institute over this precisely. Mm. It was called Les Alimentations Particulières, Special Dietary Requirements. I mean, nobody's been looking at that. Mm. You know, and what strikes me is this: when Lévi-Strauss wrote his book Triste Tropique, I don't know the English title, Sad Tropics or something like that, one of the classics in that anthropology. He tells the story of his first encounter with the Nambiquara in the Amazon. And they fed him, all they had to eat actually was a couple of spiders, some worms, some lizards, some, I forget. Now, you know, when you're offered that, what do you do? Of course, it's not particularly appealing if it's not part of your repertoire. But he writes that the anthropologist has to do that because if you're offered food, you're supposed to accept it. Otherwise, you're manifesting, you're signifying that you are in mistrust of the person or something like that.
It could be that sinister person wanting to poison them, whatever.
Poison you or whatever, or at the very least, you can pain someone who has done a big effort, etc. So he eats it. Now, I was in Australia at a meeting, and there's the speaker's dinner at a Chinese restaurant in Canberra, and next to me there's a woman who orders gluten-free spring rolls. All right. I leave aside the issue of whether there's gluten in spring rolls or not. I have no idea. But we started a conversation over this, and I asked her, have you been diagnosed with a celiac disease or something? She said, no, I haven't, but, you know, I feel much better when I do this, the classic thing. And I say, what is your field? You're an anthropologist. You tell me you're, well, I work with the Aborigines, and do they eat stuff with gluten? Well, I say, she says, I don't know, but I told them about my problem, and they make big efforts to satisfy, to cope with this, you see. So I thought it was so fascinating that it's something that is unprecedented probably in the history of mankind, that individualization of food has reached such a state, such a level, that actually rules of hospitality are in a way reversed. Mm-hmm. That you call ahead to say, I'm delighted to have dinner with you, but you have to remember I don't eat salt, or I'm under a very demanding kosher...
Happens all the time.
Happens all the time on now. This side of the Atlantic, okay. Or in Britain, or in Northern Europe. It begins to happen in France, but I can tell you that any American calling a French family, it happened recently, and I witnessed that, to say this kind of thing, meets... I mean, people are horrified. They are shocked. They say, what is this? I mean, it's just this childish behavior. I mean, they're treating me like they would a restaurant or something. There's total cultural misunderstanding there. But, I mean, what it shows, I think, is that there are basic differences between the tribes of Europe, mm-hmm. Southern Europe in particular, and the tribes of North America. They're very different if you look at them from an anthropological perspective, and I think it has to do a lot with religion. Mm. Because in Catholic countries, no matter how much practice there is of religion, there's very little in France. 8% of the French are practicing their religion, Catholic religion. But there is something in the minds of people that has left its imprint. And my theory is, and it's based on a number of data, and I can reassure you, that to the French or the Italians, to a certain extent, the meal is a communion. All right? It's like it's the Eucharist. Mm-hmm. This is my flesh, this is my blood. You're not going to be fussy if you eat the flesh and blood of Christ. Okay? To the Americans, or to some people in Northern Europe who have the Protestant, Puritan background, it's an entirely different story. It's a matter of individuals negotiating a contract. We're going to have to spend some time together eating. Let's make it as pleasant as possible and get the problems out of the way. And it's a contract. Mm. And there's a total misunderstanding on both sides of the Atlantic about this. Hmm. It can lead to confusing situations.
Yes, indeed, and sometimes inhospitable ones. So I spent 3 weeks, or 2 weeks, I guess, earlier this year in Japan, and I always, in my mind, I'm always looking at Japan opposite Italy, which I see as two cultures that have had to wrestle with a lack of food in their histories and have come to two totally different approaches to that lack. One in Italy, I think, is to sort of almost celebrate as a value the sparseness of the food, and that makes each thing a little bit more precious. And in Japan, and obviously this is based perhaps less on data and more on pure observation and my own theories, you see a fetishization of food the way that we watch on TV. I mean, to the point that every food has a ritual, has a way to do it, a place you do it in. There are so many rules around food that the food disappears almost, and you taste things that have no flavor or anything you can discern in your mouth, and Japanese are in raptures over the experience, what they're having. And I'm wondering, in these Because one of the things that has led in America, that is the topic of the conference we're here to discuss over the next few days, is this individualism, this need to satisfy my needs, has led to, I think, some really horrible consequences. Obesity, obviously there are many factors here. Hunger on one level, because people's needs and wants are considered more valuable than others, and unequal distribution, all these sorts of things. And I'm wondering, given what you've described, a lack of ritual, some changes in notions of commensality, what do you think might help this situation? I mean, can you really just sit down to dinner and together and change something, or what would your prescription be, do you think, from what you've seen and you've compared?
There's a lot that I'd like to comment in your question, which is, first of all, between Japan, Italy, and France, and the ritualization of food, of every single food, I think there's a lot, an incredible lot in common between Japan and France, contrary to what you could maybe imagine, because the sense of the ritual, of the where the food comes from, who made it, who, according to what traditions, etc. And incidentally, my friend Joël Robuchon, the well-known chef, is a living treasure of Japan.
Yes.
And I've met other living treasures of Japan, like this guy in Shizuoka, whose competence, his skills, are about massaging tea leaves. He's the only one who has the skills, and the master is 89 or something, and his young pupil is only 70. So the sense of tradition goes even far beyond that in France. And what you refer to as blend, or I think needs training and learning and appreciation. And it's a different code, a different set of norms. And I think, but basically, it's the presence of norms that is so striking in both cultures.
Okay.
And where do we go from here? And individualization, which is the fabulous fundamental issue. You know, if you ask me, like most Americans always ask, they even asked Michael Pollan, or maybe give the answer without being asked, but they're asking for rules for behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the mark of individualization.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you need rules to organize your behavior and that of your family, it means that it all depends on you. There's no point trying to figure out what is done or should be done, etc., if you have to decide by yourself. I mean, there is a point, but it's just proof that there are no collective cultural rules, or that they are...
In the land of freedom, you
exactly.
have to. You have to limit the size of soda by law, it seems, because you won't do it yourself, like you say. I mean,
no,
I'm agreeing
but, I mean,
with you.
There's a tax on soda in France as well.
Oh,
I mean,
there?
Recently, yes.
But just anti-American, I'm sure. No, I'm just kidding.
No, it's very. It probably is pro-American, and maybe it's pro-Danish, because the Danes started in the early 20s or 30s to have taxes on their sweets, but
right.
it was for moral reasons, they say, which is interesting.
Right. I mean, if there's one thing that you could think that America could do, and I know this is an unfair question, and I apologize in advance for it, but from your perspective, you know both cultures so well, I mean, you know France and America so well, and so many others, what would you tell people, if not rules, what would you tell them to do? Sit down to dinner together? Share a roast?
Well, I mean, you know, there is this thing going on that in this country that some people you know well are saying that you should start cooking from scratch again.
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting proposition. I'm not sure it can be done, because it runs counter to the entirety of human evolution, because after all, we've developed big brains. I was thinking of discussing this at the conference, but anyway... You know, we've developed big brains that are extremely greedy in terms of energy, glucose, etc. And what sense does it make? Well, it allows us to develop planning capacities, you know, like the cortex we have, and spend less time searching, foraging and looking for food and do other things. And we've spent the entirety of human evolution getting more and more time to do other things than foraging. And that's really interesting. But we've reached a point where we don't forage at all, or we do it all the time,
right,
which is the paradox, I would
right.
say. And the paradox of trivialized food, and we're back at it. So cooking from scratch runs against the entire
human
thing.
Nature.
So I think it's really very difficult to do. But if you can achieve it, then there are things that come together with it, I think. Because if you're cooking from scratch, you're not going to take people who accept people not showing up to the table at the same time, or people eating other stuff than mm-hmm. the stuff you've prepared or everything like that. So maybe it's a way of reinstoring at least something ritualized at least once in a while, etc. And that's what we do in parts of Europe, I would say, because on a daily basis, you know, people don't cook as much.
Right.
We have figures about this. Sorry.
No apologies necessary. That's a good answer. So you've heard it from Claude Fischler, everybody. Get out there and cook. Invite someone over, make a nice meal, and sit down and enjoy it. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for this conversation. I hope you'll be back, because obviously, as you said, we could go on for hours and hours and hours, and that would be a pleasure.
Thank you for inviting me.
This is Taste Matters. I'm your host. Every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, we'll have a conversation that we hope stimulates your tastes as well as your mind. And as I said, in the meantime, invite some people over, make a meal, and put the ritual back in eating. Thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.